It's the story of an American held in a dark Venezuelan prison.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
I'm Becky Bruce. I spent a year working on Hope in Darkness, which now has more than 2 million downloads. Find it on KSLpodcast.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
From the campus of the University of Utah in Salt Lake City, the Utah Debate Commission welcomes you to the 4th Congressional District Republican Primary Candidate Debate.
Good afternoon, and welcome to a debate between the four Republicans running in Utah's 4th Congressional District primary. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, executive editor of the Salt Lake Tribune. It's my great pleasure to moderate today's debate, sponsored by the Utah Debate Commission, an organization dedicated to educating voters and encouraging the civil exchange of ideas. On June 30th, Republican voters in the 4th District will choose between four challengers: Trent Christensen, State Representative Kim Coleman, Jay McFarland, and Burgess Owens. The winner will then compete in the November general election representing the Republican Party. We're live at the Dolores Story Eccles Broadcast Center on the University of Utah campus in Salt Lake City. And this debate is a bit different from past debates because of the coronavirus. There is no live audience. You'll notice our candidates are spaced 6 feet apart. We want to keep everyone safe during the hour that we're here together. During today's debate, Mr. Christensen, Representative Coleman, Mr. McFarland, and Mr. Owens will be answering my questions, as well as questions from university students, journalists, and posts on social media. So, if you're watching and listening live, send your questions to the hashtags UTDebates and Listen, Learn, Vote. The Utah Debate Commission's format today includes one to two-minute answers from each candidate, along with opportunities to offer a 30-second rebuttal. I may pose a follow-up question, and candidates will have up to 30 seconds to answer. A random drawing held prior to the debate determined that Jay McFarland will respond first to the initial question, and the order will follow after that alphabetically. So, let's begin. By way of introduction, what has prepared you most to represent the people of the 4th District? Mr. McFarland, you have a minute.
Well, I love this question. First of all, I want to thank the Utah Debate Commission. I want to thank everybody here in this room who has put together a lot of hard work to make this happen. And also, I want to thank my opponents. I can speak firsthand that getting involved in a race like this is a very difficult process. It's a huge commitment for time and away from family. So I just want to say thank you. I believe that my greatest qualifications are the fact that I've been on the radio for the last 20 years, battling it out with politicians. That's been my specific job, to go on the radio, share my ideas with people, and have them text me back or call me back and tell me why I might be wrong. And that has allowed me to hone my skills, and it has prepared me to be able to articulate a message of conservatism in such a way that it makes people really think about the platform.
Thank you. Mr. Owens, 1 minute.
As Jay just mentioned, I also want to thank everyone for this opportunity. I'm going to give you a little history that kind of gives you an idea why I'm here. I grew up in the Deep South, Tallahassee, Florida, days of segregation. At 16 years old, I was one of four black athletes who integrated a formerly all-white high school. I remember being surrounded by a bunch of guys who promised us we wouldn't be there in 2 weeks. The ringleader was Larry. Larry was a bully. He was older, bigger, stronger. He was a linebacker, and I was a running back. And in the process of seeing or going through this thing with Larry, I had a chance to talk to my dad, who gave me advice. He said, I'm going to tell you how to deal with Larry, because he wanted to hurt you every single day. You get the ball, and you run at Larry as fast as you can, hit him as hard as you can. That gave me the respect that I needed, and I needed to have at that time. We're now dealing with pure evil throughout our country, determined to destroy us, destruction everywhere. This is the time for us to get together, come together, and beat these the socialist Marxists were going after us.
Thank you, Mr. Owens. Mr. Christensen.
Thank you, Jennifer. Thank you to my opponents in the debate commission. My name is Trent Christensen, and I know how to create jobs. And I can do it in Congress for you and for your family. I'm the president of VentureCapital.org. We help first-time entrepreneurs start and grow their businesses and create jobs. We help companies like Ancestry.com, Omniture, Myriad Genetics. We've helped hundreds of companies and created 30,000 jobs in this state alone. When I was at Zions Bank, I was over a $1.4 million budget to help Utah entrepreneurs start their businesses and grow jobs. I sit on the board of the Suazo Business Center, a nonprofit dedicated to helping minorities start their businesses and create jobs. That's what I do. We create jobs. I was also the founding director of the Orange G. Hatch Center for Civility and Solutions, and I helped raise $90 million to try and help Mitt Romney defeat Barack Obama and the liberal agenda in 2012. So I'm a Utah native, I'm the son of an immigrant, and a father of four great kids. And if you're worried about the future for your kids, please vote for me. We can create jobs. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Coleman.
Hi. Thank you, Jennifer, and thank you to the Debate Commission for providing this opportunity for the voters of CD4. I've lived in the district for most of my adult life. I've grown roots there. I even helped organize hundreds of families to build a school there. I've raised my five children there. I have served in the Utah legislature for the past 6 years, where I have a conservative record, strong constitutional conservative votes across the board, and Twitter can fact check that. So I am a reliable candidate to carry this agenda to Congress. Now, for the last 2 years, we have outsourced our representation to someone who is not part of our community, does not live in our community. And that's important. As people have asked me, how do we know if we elect you, you won't go to Congress and get lost? Well, start by having someone who's already connected with you in this district. So the thing that qualifies me is that I have done it. I have cast the votes to preserve our constitutional freedoms.
Thank you so much. Let's move on to our questions. And the question that is on everyone's mind concerns the protests that we've been seeing and continue to today. The death of George Floyd by a Minneapolis police officer sparked outrage across the country. This weekend, we saw the frustration about racism and police brutality boil over into violent protests. My question to you is, how should Congress address excessive force and racism in law enforcement? And Mr. Owens, you have the first 1 minute.
I think we have to have a real straight conversation about the idea that we have such a problem with law enforcement. I think there's a process here that we have to make sure that we're communicating and allowing our forces to connect with our society, our communities. And we have not been doing that. The message over the last few years has been very simply that there's this enemy, that whites are enemy, that our society is an enemy, and we have people that are responding because of that. So I think and one of the things we need to do is, first of all, find out what's happening right now. If there is an issue with domestic terrorism, we need to address that, make sure that those bad actors, they're doing what they're doing now, if they are, to make sure they pay the price. And then let's have conversations where we can allow the police to go in and begin to develop those relationships that they've always had in the past of trust between themselves and those that they're trying to serve.
So are you saying that the message is not clear, there's a disconnect between the police? Because what sparked this is a video, and we all saw the video of this murder.
And it's no question, this was wrong. There's no debate about the heinous act that was done. The problem comes down to his response. We've come over the last few years in which anything that there's a conflict between a white policeman and a black man or black woman becomes a national issue. We should not be in that position, that point. When we are a country, we the people, we've done so much together. If we stop the narrative that the left is giving, that we're such a divided, hateful country, we're really not. We're good people, and we need to make sure we get that message
Thank
out.
Thank you. Mr. Christensen.
I appreciate that question. What happened to George Floyd was horrendous, and it is not American. The people that did that need to be prosecuted, and they will be. But what happened in Salt Lake, with the protests in Salt Lake, the violence, that was not Utah. That's not who we are. I'm a lifelong Utah and a Utah native. And that violence that we saw, that was not from Utahns. Those were people that came here to incite violence. And what we saw from someone like Don Gamble, that's what Utah's all about. That's the message we should be sending. Don Gamble's a retired correctional facility officer that spent his Sunday morning coming down from Kaysville to clean up vandalism. That's what we need. That's the message we need to send. Now, your question is, what can Congress do? Congress can support the police. Some people won't agree with that, But I'm telling you, if we give the police what they need, the training, the resources, the public support, all of the tools that they need, they can weed out the bad apples. And the level of the caliber of our police departments, of our already excellent police departments, will increase. Nobody hates a bad cop like a good cop. And if we support the police instead of doing what the media is doing and vilifying the police, if we support them, let them know we're behind them, then we can see this problem start to abate.
So the media has become vilified. Mm. And we saw violence against the media. What, as a congressperson, would you do to alleviate that kind of tension?
Well, it all comes down to message. You can't vilify any Americans. I think that's part of the problem. We're all in this together. What we saw in – let me give you an example. Nate Lede was a 24-year-old police officer who was killed in Ogden. That's what we need more of, is people who are willing to go out and do their job. And so as a congressman, if you're going to try and vilify one section of the population, whether it be the protesters or the police or the media, that's just inciting more violence. That's doing the same thing that the people who came here to incite violence to do. We need to bring the temperature down and be an example.
Thank you. Ms. Coleman.
Thank you, Jennifer. On this very University of Utah campus, I received a minor in criminology. And almost immediately, as a young mother, noticed that there was a drug house on my street, worked very closely with my neighbors to get rid of this drug house, and in great cooperation with our local police department. And throughout my life, I've had really great experiences with community policing. And I think that is a great aspiration for law enforcement to interact with the community on a very positive basis. Now, I have been a strong proponent and sponsor of legislation protecting due process. And what we saw last week was the absolute nth degree of denial of due process. Someone in authority took the life of someone. And frankly, I don't really care what he did to that point. We watched a horrendous act. What we need to do is to continue to make sure that we protect due process, that we can expect fairness, that we can expect our day in court, that we can expect that we can defend ourselves. That's what America is about.
Expand a little bit on that, though. Aren't we already in the throes of community policing? Haven't communities already embraced that as a concept? Is it working?
So I think one of the great advances that I've seen since my minor degree here at the University of Utah is an emphasis on de-escalation. So we're learning a lot more about sort of the psychological process of response to events in law enforcement. And we have moved quite a bit to the operational de-escalation. That's where we really have to start. What happened that this got so carried away? Why were there bystander officers that were complicit?
Time. Thank you. Mr. McFarland.
Well, I think the answer is simple. We need leadership, and I don't see it. We have a vacuum of leadership. And in order to have good leadership, you have to have good listeners. And I see a lot of people rushing to every corner and blaming the media or blaming the police officers or blaming the protesters. Who is going to sit back and actually listen to what is going on? You cannot come up with real solutions unless you listen. And I'll tell you one of the most wonderful things I saw, and we reported on it when I was with KSL. About a year and a half ago, Black Lives Matter was going to have a breakfast protest. The local police department reached out to them and said, why don't we make it a picnic? And what they did is they brought together the police officers and the members of Black Lives Matter. And you know what happened? It humanized the equation for everybody. Suddenly, these aren't numbers or statistics. They're real people. We need listeners first.
Can you talk about the congressional piece of that leadership vacuum that you say you see?
Well, I think that leadership has to come from the White House and it has to come from Congress. We need people who are I've been watching all weekend. I see members of Congress coming out and pointing the finger and pointing blame and making demands without listening to the issue. We clearly have an entire population in our country who feel disenfranchised, who do not have the same American experience as others do. We have to figure out why. why before we propose any solutions.
Thank you so much. Let's move on to the other big news of the day, the pandemic. 106,000 Americans have lost their lives and 40 million are unemployed due to the coronavirus. What is the best thing that Congress has done in response to the pandemic? What is the worst thing? And what's the most important thing that Congress should do going forward? And you have 2 minutes, Mr. Christensen.
The best thing they've done is to support small businesses. It took some time and it took some negotiating, but Republicans and President Trump were able to wrangle out of a Nancy Pelosi House of Representatives enough stimulus to help small business owners, to help individuals to get through this time. That's the best thing they've done so far. The worst is having to take so long to do it because Nancy Pelosi wanted to give so much money to her cronies, to her unions, to the Democratic bosses. And we're seeing it again. She's already proposed a $3 trillion deal, which has no hope of winning in the Senate or being signed by the president, but it's just a negotiation tactic. If Congress really wants to make a difference, they need to move forward with a plan that will help small business owners. Now, I have experience in the economy. If someone's a manager, they know how to deal with problems that are right in front of them. If someone's a leader, they're able to look around the corner and see the problems that are coming. If someone's a politician, they do neither of those two things. So let's talk about being a leader. There are states in this country right now, New York, California, Illinois, who are saying that they're not going to open for business until they get a bailout. And that means a bailout from you and me, our money. And they're going to hold their economies hostage. And some might say, well, fine, let them do that. But that hurts our economy. Because if you want to export something through L.A. or market something in New York, you can't do it because they're closed for business. So even if we in Utah open responsibly, we still are suffering because other states around the country won't do it. So we need legislation. We need smart people who have been in the private sector to say, this is how we're going to open the whole country. I would, if you're asking what Congress would do next, I would have one last final round of stimulus, but I would tie it to being open 100% as of June 15th. And the states that aren't open on June 15th, they don't get the money. If they open on September 1st, they get that money retroactive to June 15th. We have to give a carrot and a stick approach. The president's already said he's going to sue the government, the governors who don't open their states by a certain date, and this would be a carrot approach. Open up. Let's stimulate. Let's create jobs and help small business owners.
Thank you. Ms. Coleman, 2 minutes.
Thank you, Jennifer. The things that we did right, I want to echo what Mr. Christensen said about protecting small businesses, that we were able to, the Congress was able to provide some stimulus for this short period of time. The other good thing that President Trump and the Congress did was exercise federalism and allow states really to exercise their rights to respond to this disease in a manner that they feel is appropriate to that state. And we've seen very different responses across the country. That was great. We got to respond very specifically as a state. The things that we didn't do well, again, as has been mentioned, was the proposed stimulus. If Republicans in the Senate have to continue to negotiate with the Democrats in the House, we're going to get these kinds of pork barrel types of proposals. And in addition to what's been mentioned, Nancy Pelosi is suggesting that red states that have healthy economies would bail out blue states that have not been as responsible as Utah. So America was enjoying the greatest peacetime economy in our history prior to COVID. Utah itself has been a leader on every economic metric you can think of. We've had the best economic outlook for over a decade running. We have the best upward mobility and socioeconomic status. We've got great outcomes in our education system. We have some of the best tax policy, business-friendly tax policy in the country, very, very pro-business. And for us to then have to bail out other states who have not been as responsible as we have is not serving the citizens of our country well or the citizens of CD4. That one thing we can do, one proposal could be to suspend the payroll taxes through the end of the year, which would be a 7% income increase to most citizens.
Thank you so much. And Mr. McFarland, 2 minutes.
Well, I think back on history, and I'm trying to think of a time when a president has had to balance lives with livelihoods. And you think about that balance that he is trying to find. Maybe three times in the history of our country has a president have to make that choice. And I think he's done as best a job as anybody could without a playbook. I agree with my opponents that passing that first stimulus was key. But the truth is, the stimulus checks still aren't all out. The PPP loans still aren't all out. We are watching businesses go under on a regular basis. We started out the minute that this COVID-19 shutdown started to happen. We went around to every small business we could find. We found out what their needs were, and we went on our social media and used our platforms, not to campaign, but to encourage people to go out every single day that they could. If they could afford it, and to spend money in those businesses. Because the truth of the matter is, if we don't, they're going to be gone. And you think about all of the jobs, all of the livelihoods that are going to be gone if we don't do more. So I am in favor of a second stimulus package. I want it to focus on two areas only, and that's employers and employees, so that we can keep ourselves out of another Great Depression. This wait around and see approach is, we're going to find out if it worked or not too late. And that's my fear. We need to be proactive because these businesses are dying. I spoke to a business owner yesterday. He thinks he has about 2 weeks left, and then that's it. He'll close his doors. He'll let his employees go, and he'll never know if he'll be able to get back into business again. This is how we stay out of another Great Depression.
Thank you. Mr. Owens.
I agree with the other folks here. There's no question the real focus at this point has to be on small business owners. In my history, I grew up in a segregated South, Tallahassee, Florida, at a time where the black community actually led our country in the growth of middle class, matriculating college, and more importantly, percentage of entrepreneurs. The culture of our nation, the strength of our nation, is our middle class. Our middle class is being attacked. It's being attacked by attacking the power of this class, which is the small business owners. What we did, we started off this process, is the very best the president could have done. We didn't know the enemy, so we decided to shut down the most vibrant economy we've ever had in the history of our country, where middle class was being built and strengthened. And now we're at a point where we understand that. What we really need to understand is, first of all, we cannot do the things we're talking about here unless we get back to the House. The reason why we're being held hostage is because the Democrats are run by Marxists and socialists, and they could care less about the middle class. They can care less about we, the people, the small business owners. Matter of fact, the more misery that we experience, the more power they get. That's the greatest, I think, lack of lesson that we are having today, is understanding our true enemy. Once we understand that, we can start to, together, no matter what side of the aisle we're on, to come together and focus on the things that will make our business, our economy grow again. Business ownership, business, small business owners, and within the Congress, allow them to allow our president to continue to do what he's doing. He's the right man at the right time. He understands business. He understands how to kick it off again. He needs to have a support team that will actually allow him to do what he has to do without laying additional burden on the coming generations.
Terrific. Thank you so much. This is a very short 15-second one. Do you wear a mask in public places? And if not, why not? Mr. Christensen, you go first.
I don't. If a business asks me to do so in order to patronize their business, I will. But I believe it's a choice. I don't have a problem with masks. What I do have a problem with is being told I have to wear a mask. That's not how we do things in America. What you're going to see is a vaccine come out for this. And what I don't want to have happen is them saying, well, you had to wear a mask. Now you need to have a vaccine. So in America, we get to choose. And I allow people the same choice without judgment.
Terrific. Ms. Coleman.
Thank you. So we are learning more about this virus every day, and we now understand the risk categories. So I don't generally wear a mask in public, but I do try to honor and respect the distancing when I am out in public.
Terrific. Mr. McFarland.
I don't understand who's making you wear a mask. People talk about this being a personal liberty. The request has been made by Republican leadership to put on a mask. It may help your neighbor. It may help your family member. I have a daughter who has extreme asthma. It may help her. Nobody has a gun to your head. Part of exercising personal liberty is to do so responsibly. What happened to love thy neighbor? What happened to civil respect for other people?
Time.
I wear a mask when I'm in public for that
Time.
Reason.
Thank you. Mr. Owens.
I don't. And the reason being is, first of all, I choose not to. I think what it comes down to is we have small businesses or locations like this that set in place an environment where people can feel safe. If people want to be in a place where masks is being dictated, then go for it. But in terms of myself, I don't. I think a lot of it has to come down to also just getting trust again in our system. To be told the things we were told at one point, masks is not important. Masks is a danger. Now masks is required. Those are the kind of things that the conflict of information is not good for our country and to believe in what they're doing.
Thank you very much. We're now going to go to a question from a journalist in our audience, our very limited audience, Glenn Mills, senior political correspondent and anchor at ABC4.
Thank you very much. Candidates, my question is on health care. It is consistently a top issue on the minds of voters here in the state of Utah and even across the country, and probably even more so now that we've seen millions of our fellow Americans lose jobs recently. So on that note, my question is this. The Affordable Care Act provides an opportunity for millions of Americans, tens of thousands here in the state of Utah who may otherwise go without. Do you support a repeal of the ACA? Why or why not? And if so, what is the solution?
Let's see.
I think it's Coleman.
Sorry. Ms. Coleman, you have 2 minutes to answer.
Thank you. I do support a repeal of the ACA. America does enjoy some of the best health care access, some of the most innovative health care, some of the best quality health care in our whole entire world. We are the envy of the world with our health care. And what challenges we do have in health care are better resolved through free market principles. And the ACA took us in an entirely different direction. Now, there are pieces of the ACA that people like and would like to see remain in a repeal or repeal and replace. But what we've seen over the last year in particular, but in the last couple months, some of the problems with our health care system have been they've been exposed even more. That for about a year, I've been reading a book called China Rx. I read this book about a year ago. Now, China Rx revealed the fact that we have outsourced our pharmaceutical manufacturing to China, and now we realize how dangerous that is. The CCP is largely to blame, I would say fully to blame, for this pandemic. They did not care about America. They did not care about people around the world. They didn't care about their own citizens when this pandemic unleashed on the world. But then we found out they also control the manufacturing of personal protection equipment. So we're waiting for equipment to come from China that doesn't meet our quality standards. And so we really have problems with what we've done with manufacturing in the healthcare world. But what we can do to fix it is more cost transparency, getting rid of things like safe harbor provisions for our pharmaceutical benefits managers that have absolutely escalated the price of drugs. What can be fixed, or what our problems are, can be fixed more with free market principles.
Thank you. Mr. McFarland, 2 minutes.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that one of the problems with Congress and government is they don't ask the question why something is happening. So our health insurance is experiencing 8-10% inflation a year, where the rest of the country is at about 1.5%. So you have to ask the question, what on earth is allowing health care to grow at such an aggressive pace? And Kim mentioned free market forces. There are no free market forces in health care. I'll give you an example. When I lived in Texas, we had a hailstorm. One night, softball-sized hail came through and destroyed every roof in the neighborhood. The insurance adjuster came out, and he looked at our roof, and he wrote me a check, and he handed it to me, and he said, good luck, go and repair your roof. Guess what I did with that money? I shopped around. I actually got bids. I actually was involved in the decision with my roof. We're not involved in our healthcare decisions. The insurance providers pay the healthcare providers, and we don't know what the costs are. We don't have options to pick and choose. We don't have the ability to choose one value over another value. I think one simple change that could be made is to make it so insurance insurance providers have to pay consumers and not providers. And then once that happens, you're going to see consumers suddenly involved again in their healthcare decisions. Free market forces will drive costs down. Is that a solution to every problem? Absolutely not. But we have to always ask the question, why is there hyperinflation? The answer usually is simple, because free market forces are not in play. Congress's job, get the free market forces back in play. Regulate interstate commerce and do your job.
Thank you. Mr. Owens.
This is exactly how we get it done. When we the people start talking, giving us our answers, being creative, we'll find solutions. The problem we've had is systemic. We've had more and more government regulations, more and more government dictation. And in the process of doing that, we've actually lost the opportunity to do what we're not talking about doing right now. It comes down to free market and government. What we've seen happen again with this virus, we have ventilators. 100,000 made within a few months where it normally took 30,000. It's because of creativity, because of private market and government working together. We should approach this in the same way. Make sure competition is there, transparency is there. Make sure that we're cutting out the middlemen that don't need to be there anymore. Again, once we have the competition and once we have conversations like this where people truly care about the end game, we the people, we'll start coming with solutions that right now we're not even thinking about, because it's been so far hand off to bureaucrats to come up with solutions for us.
I'm Mr. Christensen.
Well, I appreciate the question. Good to see you again, Glenn. Obamacare needs to be fully rooted out 100%. And by that, I mean not just repealed, but when something like Obamacare, something that massive, is passed, the regulatory agencies go to work as fast as they can to dig down in roots and create regulations based off of that legislation. So there are regulations a mile long that were derived from Obamacare that have to be rooted out. We've talked a lot about market forces. Those are stymied by the regulations that unelected bureaucrats have been writing for years. And so it's going to take an effort to root out all of the regulations, and there hasn't been a single president better in history at reducing regulations and regulatory costs than President Trump. So the answer to your question is yes, but yes, all of it. It's those regulations that are stopping market forces. But you also have to understand why hasn't it been done yet? I think all of us understand that free market forces are going to be best to help lower costs, right? Obamacare is the reason for hyperinflation. Those regulations. But what we found is there's a segment of D.C. that wants those regulations in place, that benefit from those regulations being in place, and those are Democrats and lobbyists. And so when you go back to D.C., you had better have a very firm grasp on what this details, what it entails, the regulations that need to be pulled back, and you better not be beholden to those lobbyists, because they're the ones that want those in place. Now, one thing that was mentioned earlier is federalism. We should be taking the money and block granting it to the states. Utah is an amazing state. We're not like Nebraska. We're not like Florida. We ought to spend that money and customize it in a way that benefits you, not in a way that the federal government dictates will be the best for everyone. So that money ought to be block granted to the states and allow the states to customize a program that works best for its citizens. And last thing, there's a lot of discussion about healthcare and data. I don't think we're using the data wisely. I don't think we've been using the data wisely in a discussion on how to open up and how to create jobs. And if we use that data wisely, we can find how to employ free market forces and bring jobs back to the economy. Saving jobs saves lives.
Thank you very much. Did you have a follow-up, Glenn?
Just real quick, if I could. This has been a very partisan issue in the nation's capital. The ACA was passed without one single Republican vote. The Republicans recently tried to get their own plan in. And the late Senator John McCain came out and put an end to that. So for the most part, very partisan. Are we just going to sit and let the pendulum swing every time a different party takes control of Washington and just keep changing the system back and forth?
Ms. Coleman, we'll start with you. 30 seconds, please.
The nature of our political system is that we have a two-party system, and that has, for a number of reasons, become even more polarized over time. There are places with health care. There are places with immigration policy. There are places with economic policy that we really can come together and agree on some things. The problem is sometimes compromise is asking that one side give everything, and that's what we're not seeing in Congress right now. I have a record of working across the aisle as a state legislator.
Thank you. Mr. McFarland.
Well, I think the pendulum is there because of who we're sending. And I think we have to change who we're sending. If we're choosing extremes who can't even look at the other side, can't even talk to the other side, how can we expect them to come together with any solutions? Calling them Marxists, calling them all kinds of evil names in the book, and then you want to go to Washington and say, hey, sit down with me and let's come up with a solution together? It's not reasonable. We need to choose people who can talk to each other.
Thank you. Mr. Owens.
We're at a point where our country truly is at risk. And yes, we're working against Marxists and socialists, and they can care less about the solutions we're trying to find here. The memo, the modus operandi for Marxists and socialists is a use, abuse, and discard. We need to get our house back, a house that's different than in the past, with a freshman class that cares about our country, that are patriots, very similar to our president. Together, we'll care about our country first. We'll get that done with, come with solutions we need, but understand the enemy. It is Marxism and socialism that's driving this, dividing us at this point.
And Mr. Christensen?
Glenn, I think the answer to that is no. The pendulum isn't going to continue to swing, because if you send people like me to Congress, the power of our ideas will defeat the opposition. And by that, I mean, I patterned my policymaking after Orrin Hatch. Orrin Hatch passed the American Disabilities Act with broad bipartisan support. He passed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, something that could never pass today, and he did it with broad bipartisan support. And he did it because his ideas were better. And he was able to put them forward in a way that wasn't demeaning, but to say, no, this is the best idea. Let's move forward. And with me in Congress, we could do that.
Time. Thank you very much. Sure. Yes. 15 seconds, please.
We're at a different time. The days of Ronald Reagan, Tip O'Neill, that's past. We're dealing with people who hate our country. We need to understand that. That's our enemy. We need to get a party in place that's strong enough to run the process and put our agenda first so that we, the people, can get an option and understand where we need to go moving forward.
Ms. Coleman?
You haven't done your homework. Orrin Hatch passed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act when Bill Clinton was the president, and he got it passed through Bill Clinton.
Time. Ms. Coleman, 15 seconds, please.
We need to not be afraid to identify the challenge that it is. We need to not be afraid to call the problem of socialists in Congress, running Congress right now, for what it is. If we can't use the right words, and by the way, they call themselves that.
Mr. McFarland, 15 seconds.
If the times have passed, does that mean we can't go back? Does that mean they're gone forever? Or can we choose leaders who are wiser, who know how to communicate without the attacks and the personal insults? Are there no more Ronald Reagans in our community? I think there are. I think we should find them, and I think we should elect them.
Thank you. Our time is up on that round. If you're just joining us, we're about halfway through a primary election debate featuring Republican candidates running for Utah's 4th district seat in the U.S. House of Representatives. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce of the Salt Lake Tribune, and we're still taking your questions during this live broadcast. Use the hashtags UTDebates and listen, learn, vote. Back now to questions, and we have a question from Thomas Burr, who is Washington Bureau Chief of the Salt Lake Tribune.
Hi, I'm Thomas Burr with the Salt Lake Tribune. My question is, the U.S. debt has swelled to $25 trillion and counting. How would you reverse course with that, and would that include cuts to Social Security and Medicare?
Jay McFarland, one minute.
This is one of the number one reasons why I left my job at KSL, because I'm embarrassed by the debt that is going to be handed over to my children. And if you think about it, what could we do with this money, this debt service, if we had it to spend? We could spend it on Social Security, and we wouldn't have any problems. Yes, we have to make cuts. Yes, we have to make changes to Social Security. I don't think we reduce the benefit, but I think that you have to change the age. People are working longer. They're living longer. And I think you have to change the income cap on top of that. I also want to get the federal government out of education completely. They have no constitutional authority to be there, and those monies need to stay in our state in the first place. Paying down the debt would be one of my number one priorities, even with COVID-19 making it that much more difficult. But it needs to be a top priority so that our great-grandchildren aren't born with a huge amount of debt.
Time. Mr. Owens, 1 minute.
It's a couple of things. We need to, first of all, look at where we are. We have $50 billion in waste. Rand Paul just came out with a report recently. We need to be looking at ways to make sure our small businesses are continually growing. We need to be looking at relocating government entities, agencies, out of D.C. into the Midland so we begin to cut the costs and save our tax money, pay us a little bit more money. And most importantly, we need to also keep our promises. For those that we made promises for Social Security, we need to keep those to keep our word. We need to make sure that we put in place an incentive for those young people coming through that know they will not get it to have some more choice, some more options, in which they can possibly go into an IRA that's a benefit to them, that gives them even a better lifestyle when they come to that retirement age. We can do this through a nice, again, creative entrepreneurial approach to this process, which has not happened up to this point.
Thank you. Mr. Christensen?
Well, I appreciate the question. President Trump and his budget that he released in January, and granted this was pre-COVID-19, but his budget said that he would, based on that budget, if it was adhered to, we could eliminate, not reduce, eliminate the national debt in 15 years. And some people may say, well, that's too long, or that's too, you know, that's pie in the sky, it's too short. But the point is, we have leadership right now that's willing to take the leadership role and reduce the debt and eliminate it. What it takes is resolve, because what it's pointed out is this isn't something that you go back to D.C. with a silver bullet on. I am in favor of a balanced budget amendment. I think that should absolutely be added to the Constitution and that Congress should only spend what they have. But even that isn't a silver bullet to fix the problem. What it's going to take is someone like President Trump, a business person who saw problems in this country and said, hey, I've got the background to fix those. I can streamline the government. I can take on these issues. I have that business experience. I can take on those issues and I can help President Trump reduce the national debt.
Thank you. Ms. Coleman?
Thank you, Jennifer. I've actually voted in support of a balanced budget amendment in Congress. Last year, about a year ago, Mick Mulvaney, in a meeting I was in with him, explained that our deficit and debt is not so attributable to the entitlements, and I think that's what we usually think of, but it is the discretionary spending that is driving up the debt. That is something we can do something about. Now, as a Utah House legislator, I'm currently actively in the process of cutting a budget, and it started in sort of this mode that we know we're going to have to cut. So let's look at 5%, 10%. But there was a discussion about let's try to designate which things are have-to-haves, which things are we probably should fund, but it's going to be really hard if we cut all the way down the list to this was somebody's pet project. I'm asking myself, why did we have a 3 through 5 in the first place? Why is the state government doing this? Time. We have this problem in Congress.
Thank you. Mr. McFarland?
Didn't I go first?
Oh, I'm sorry. Pardon me. We're going to go now to Twitter. We have a question from Tina Peck via Facebook. What is your opinion on Mayor Mendenhall's handling of the protest and rioting this past weekend? And Mr. Owens, I believe you go first.
Well, first of all, I'm
going to
echo what was said earlier. This is not who we are. For this to happen in Utah means that somebody's coming in to get it done. I think in the most part, we cut it down pretty quickly. What bothered me, of course, is when you see a great city like this, a great church we have, to be vandalized and to have the latitude that some people are given to actually go in and go into these malls. We have to recognize, again, this is not organic. Once we realize that we truly have an enemy, we have Antifa right now. We have a terrorist organization that literally across this country wreaking havoc. We need to have mayors across the board, not just this one, that understand our enemy and not give leeway. Is the stronger we can come down with those who are vandalizing peaceful demonstrations, something that I've lived with all my life. I believe in it. But we know that there's a process, a theme that's going throughout this where there's vandalism, there's attacking on innocent people. We need to address that quickly. I love seeing what I did with the police. They end up doing a good job.
Thank you, Mr. Owens. And Mr. Christensen.
I think that she built a good team, and she listened and worked with that team. And that's the hallmark of good leadership. She worked with the Salt Lake police, and they did an excellent job. And the proof of that is that what you saw on Saturday night, you didn't see it Sunday night, but you saw it elsewhere in the country. You saw it in Atlanta. You saw it in Minneapolis. But we had a response that was able to bring the temperature down and get those people who are from out of state, who are inciting violence, get them out. Listen, the people inciting violence, they're the enemies. okay? Not the protesters, not the police. The protesters are hurt and scared and they're angry and they have a right to voice that. That's how you heal. But the police are there to protect the rights of those who can't protect themselves. It's those protesters who incite violence who are the enemy of any American who wants to move forward towards a society in which every American can live in peace. And to the degree that we support our police, we will be able to see this in the future. When those out-of-staters come in, lower the temperature and take care of business. Don't raise the temperature, and we'll be able to see progress.
Thank you. Ms. Coleman?
Thank you. I'd like to echo what my fellow candidates have said to this point, and including that the state was ready and prepared with the National Guard should that be needed. And we are identifying the enemy. The enemy is being called out, is being named, and is being prepared for. And so I agree with those statements as well. I want to talk about just something a little bit different. Is we also saw a daytime curfew. We haven't seen that anywhere else in the country that I'm aware of. And so for the last month or so, people have asked me frequently, can the government do this to me? Can they tell me that I have to stay in my home, shut my business down? Can they tell me, can they really put out a hotline to snitch on your neighbors? And I say, yes, they can. If we let them, and this is the problem, we need to, in a crisis, whatever the crisis is, we absolutely have to balance that with our civil rights to due process, as we've talked about, but no infringement of our rights.
The time is up. Thank you. Mr. McFarland?
Well, I'm a huge supporter of personal rights and liberties and the amendments in the Constitution. I think that they're inherent to everything that makes this country great, but In wise leadership, you have to know and understand that there are times when those things get stretched. We recognize that when we say you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. Well, what about my free speech rights to say whatever I want? Well, there comes a point where the exercise of those personal freedoms and those rights warrant some type of action to save lives, to save businesses. That's what happened in Salt Lake. That's what mayors and governors have been trying to balance throughout this country. The Constitution is not a death sentence. There have been plenty of times throughout our history when personal liberties for a short time have had to be rescinded because it's not a death sentence. The key is to have good enough leadership to make sure you land back where you started. And those losses aren't permanent.
Time, Mr. McFarland. Mr. Christensen has requested 15 seconds on rebuttal, so I'll give the same liberties to you. Mr. Christensen,
I actually disagree a lot with what's just been said. Okay. I don't think there is ever a time when you are allowed to rescind personal liberties, ever. But I don't want to conflate what happened in Salt Lake and those protests with what happened during COVID. That's absolutely constitutional, and that curfew came up between the police and the mayor, and it worked.
Thank you. Thank you. Anyone else want to avail?
Also, do you think that you should be able to yell fire in a crowded theater? That's a violation of free speech.
It's completely besides the point, Jay.
Why?
Because we're not talking about, we had insiders that were screaming and flipping over police cars and torching police cars and someone with a crossbow. And those people need to be stopped. And when the police says initiate a curfew, you do it.
Ms. Coleman?
That's right.
As the chair of the National Center to Protect Free Speech and a six-year sponsor of free speech protection rights and due process, screaming fire in a theater is not protected and is not part of the real conversation about First Amendment rights.
And Mr. Owens.
We have to, as we have this conversation, again, realize our enemy. We are not in normal times. So, yes, after this wave of riots across the country, we need to know that there's a certain type of people coming here to do damage and be ready for it from the very beginning. That's something that we can prepare for, get ready for, and end it from the very beginning.
Thank you. One last video question. This is from Autumn Thatcher. She's a student at Southern Utah University.
Hi, my name is Autumn Thatcher, and I'm from Southern Utah University. My question is, in a country where politics have become extremely divisive, how will you work if elected with people that you may disagree with to find compromises that will benefit the people of Utah?
Mr. Christensen.
I really
appreciate 30 seconds. We got to keep it short.
I really appreciate that question. There is no ability to succeed in business without being able to reach across and find win-win solutions. Just because somebody disagrees with you 90% of the time doesn't mean you can't find 10% agreement. I refuse to believe that there is any issue on which you can't find some agreement with someone. Mike Lee did it. He passed the crime bill and he got help from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to do it. So on every issue, we can find where we work together. Orrin Hatch did it with Ted Kennedy, and I can do it in Congress.
Thank you, Ms. Coleman. 30 seconds.
Okay, so thank you for the question. So I sponsored a bill with Senator Jim DeBacchus, and on the political spectrum, we may be just about, as far as reaching across the aisle, that is a big aisle. But we worked together because we did find that common ground. It was a First Amendment bill, and we put our heads together. And by the way, I frequently chose to sit by him. I wanted to hear his side. I could hear my side all day long, but I wanted to hear Senator DeBacchus' side. He also made me laugh sometimes. But we knew intuitively, First Amendment
time
is important to everybody, all sides
Thank
of the
you.
Spectrum.
Mr. McFarland.
Well, you can't do it by labeling them. You can't do it by insulting them. You can't do it by broad brushing them. You have to have a willingness to actually hear what they have to say. You have to treat them like an American citizen, like they are a patriot who just believes in a different way than you do. And they have every right to come to legislative halls and to fight for what they believe. They are representing people who voted for them who want them to fight for those things. So you can't do it unless you're willing to listen and
Thank
have
you.
Respect.
Time. Mr. Owens.
I'm in a family that I'm probably the only Republican in it. We disagree on pretty much everything. We love each other, and we will come together and figure out a way to still continue moving forward. That's good. That's the American way. We're dealing with people who hate our country. I will not negotiate and compromise with anyone who hates my country because they have a totally different game, end game. We need to make sure we have a Congress that's full of patriots, people who love our country, and we even there we might have disagreements. But if we're on the same page, in the same end game, we'll come to the right conclusions. Negotiating with people who hate us is not an option.
Time. We have a strict 1 minute. We're really pushing the limits here. Our time is up. We're going to move to the final questions. You will have 1 minute with no rebuttal. And Mr. Owens, you go first.
I'm sorry, this is
final
okay.
statement.
I think the greatest of our country is that how well we've done, we the people together. And it's because of tenets we've been raised with that we believe in. And we can all agree on, all of us right here today. Head, heart, hands, and home. It's education, God, industry, and family. That's the American way. I think my message is one that allows us to have that conversation. We might have a different way of getting there, but we will agree to disagree and get ourselves there. At the same time, that's those same tenets allow us to understand we have an enemy today, guys, not in advance with Ronald Reagan or even Clinton. We have an enemy the last few years, which they're truly trying to undermine our country. We see it on the streets every single day, where innocent people are being attacked. So let's make sure that we put in Congress. We need to get this House back. I think of all the candidates here, I'm the best person to get that done. We get the House back. We get a position of supporting our president. We have another 4 years of truly remarkable growth and unity once again as we the people do our thing best.
Thank you, Mr. Christensen.
I don't know why we talk about getting the House back when so many of you don't have your job back yet. That's what I'm going to focus on. In order to fix the economy, you need to understand it here, but you also need to understand it in your heart. It has to matter to you. It has to be something that you're passionate about. I want to see you succeed because I know what it feels like to struggle. When I was 6, my dad was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, and 10 years later, he couldn't walk or work. So my mom, an immigrant to this country, took over. And we got by, but I saw her work and struggle and worry every day to help her 6 kids be the best they could be. I watched her fight for us, and I will fight for you. I'm not running for Congress because I want a new career. I'm fighting for Congress because your job, your small business, the future of this country, they are far too important. I am a traditional conservative, and I am a job creator. And until we, the people, require those two things, someone with a conservative's heart and a job creator's mind, we will have the same Ben Pelosi, Ben McAdams, Nancy Pelosi all over again. Vote for me. I can help you
Time.
Get your job back. Thank you.
Ms. Coleman.
Thank you. I want to start by talking about what this race really is about. Over the next month, people are going to be deciding on which of us is the better candidate to beat Ben McAdams and to represent their values, their principles, their home in Congress. Now, frequently, We get lots of lip service frequently. People say we have agreed largely on most things today. You don't see a whole lot of difference in what we are talking about. But the difference is too frequently we just hear the talk and then we hope that they're going to do what they say. With me, I've done it. I have 6 years of a voting record. I've gone to our state capitol and I've voted constitutionally, conservatively for 6 years straight across the board. If you vote for me, you don't have to vote and hope. You can vote for me and know. So please vote for me. I'd love your support. And KimForUtah.com.
Thank you, Mr. McFarland.
Well, if you're a Republican, I think probably your number one concern this year is getting rid of Ben McAdams. If you get rid of Ben McAdams, then you can probably say goodbye to Nancy Pelosi as well. So the math that you're probably doing in your head is which person on this stage has the best ability to do that. I believe that I have the greatest opportunity to do that because I've engaged in a 9-year-long conversation with Utahns about the issue. They know me. They know my heart. They know my mistakes. They know my trials. They know everything about me. And that has allowed me to bring people from the left over to my side of the aisle and independents over to my side of the aisle. And the reality is, 2 years ago, District 4 chose a moderate Democrat. What makes you think that suddenly they're going to choose an extreme conservative? They're not. They're going to look for a moderate to represent them. That's who I am, somebody who can communicate with the other side and get things done.
Thank you. Trent Christensen, Kim Coleman, Jay McFarland, and Burgess Owens, thank you all very much for your time today, and good luck to you in the Republican primary election on June 30th for the 4th Congressional District. Thank you all for joining us out in the ether. And thanks for the questions. Thanks to the University of Utah, as well as PBS Utah, for hosting us today. And to our sponsors, the Larry H. and Gail Miller Family Foundation and doTERRA Essential Oils. Thanks to everyone who participated, to the Utah Debate Commission co-chairs Karen Hale and Wayne Niederhauser, and to Nina Sliding, the Debate Commission's executive director. Mail-in ballots go out next week, so definitely get registered. And don't forget to return that postmarked ballot by primary election day, June 30th. As we saw over the weekend, many are looking for change in this country, and voting is one of the most powerful ways we can improve life for us all. On behalf of the Utah Debate Commission, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Thanks so much for tuning in.